Welcome to the Barth Calderon Wealth Protector Podcast. Our founder, Harry Barth, and his son, Brad, are top speakers on asset protection and estate planning to many incredible groups across the country, including the Women Presidents Organization, Vistage, the Young Presidents Organization, the California Apartment Association, and many more. And now, here is your host, Paul Hitchcock.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Paul Hitchcock. I'm with the asset protection, estate planning, business planning firm, Barth Calderon, and excited to have this event today. I have two great attorneys here. One is my colleague, David Calderon, top attorney in asset protection, estate planning, business planning for the firm, and Steve Williams, who is a founder and partner at Freed Williams Grice Connor. Welcome, both of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yeah. Yeah. And Steve, I thought we'd start with you. And again, this can be as interactive as we want it to be. But Steve, you know, Steve's landlord attorney dealing with property owners all over the place. And Steve, this is sort of a, you know, what are some of the hot issues going on with landlords today? What you think they should be aware of? And then we're going to get into David's input on how to legally instill some asset protection and what you should be thinking about when you're a property owner. But Steve, you want to jump right in?
Yeah, well, glad you asked. I actually put together just a little bullet point slideshow. If you want me to share my screen, that I can hit a couple of points and everyone can kind of see where I'm going. So yeah, I'll just cover just a few areas, some hot topics I'm seeing right now for property owners who have rental properties in California in particular, and in the Bay Area. I'm in the Bay Area, but a lot of these things apply statewide. So these are just some of the things I'm going to hit on. I know I don't have a whole lot of time, but I'll just hit them all quickly. But one of the COVID-19 declarations of emergency, the COVID declarations that have been issued dating back to March of 2020. And then rental assistance. Now that's a big topic, tenants getting rental assistance to help them pay the rent. Also, just some other governmental emergency declarations, and you might be kind of surprised to hear some of these, but I'll touch on those. And then briefly, AB 1482, which is statewide rent and eviction control, and then just a couple of ADA claims, and then the importance of insurance. Now, it sounds like a lot, but I'll go through it pretty quickly. You know, that way we'll hit these topics pretty quickly, and just a general overview of some of these things. The first being The COVID-19, like I mentioned, declarations literally are coming to an end as we speak in many areas. Just to put into perspective, they were issued, California issued one back in, March of 2020, and it literally just came to an end. They just dissolved it February 28th, so just last month, the beginning of this month. The state of emergency in California was lifted. So for 3 years, we had emergency related to COVID-19. And as a result, some of the other local jurisdictions are also dissolving theirs as well. Berkeley has up here in the Bay Area. San Francisco has not yet, but...
Steve, is this a national thing? So the government declarations coming off across the country?
Well, each state individually can issue their own declarations of emergency. Okay. I know California has been one of the leaders in that, probably one of the getting in early and issuing them, and probably one of the later ones in dissolving them. But that doesn't mean that other states don't also still have some declaration of emergency going. And this is important also, is that related to COVID-19 are eviction moratoriums, precluding evictions. Now, that lifted in California some time ago, but each city may have their own special rule. Like for instance, Alameda County, Berkeley, Oakland, other local cities have emergency moratoriums still in place that preclude most types of evictions. So you just need to be aware of that and check whatever jurisdiction your rental property is in to see if there's any ongoing moratorium on evictions, and now it may be related to COVID-19. There are still a lot of implications of COVID-19 and the impacts still affecting the rental market and the ability of landlords to recover possession of property in some jurisdictions. Now, rental assistance, now that was, you know, there was a huge program associated with COVID-19 at the state level that provided rent relief, a big rent relief program. That came to an end in March last year. Now, so you can no longer avail yourself of any unpaid rent through that program, but there are still programs at local levels that offer assistance to tenants in need. And it can be related to COVID-19 or it can be just related to other circumstances. You know, here in the Bay Area, there's many different organizations that help local tenants with the payment of rent, whether it's some sort of a grant, a loan, whatever, they will oftentimes make rent payments on behalf of tenants. And what I've seen is they generally do that in response to a non-payment of rent eviction notice. So to save the tenant, sort of at the end, when the tenant's about to be evicted, these organizations may step up and offer some assistance. So if you have a tenant that's not paying rent and you're in discussions with that tenant, have that tenant and yourself check any potential local available programs that may be able to offer assistance to that tenant. And then that will save, you know, everyone some time and money, hopefully, having to go through an eviction process. So yeah, keep that in mind. Now, just because the COVID declarations of emergency are ending, guess what? There are other declarations of emergency, as you know, or may not know. Just over the last year, we've seen California issue declarations of emergency for fires, if you remember, drought, and then, of course, too much rain. And now we have one in effect for the snowstorm. So certain counties in California have declarations of emergency in effect right now for the snowstorms. Some are still ongoing regarding the rainstorms as well as the drought. And what is the effect of these emergencies on the rental market and the property market? It can be significant because there is an anti-price gouging law. It's a criminal law that goes into effect for at least 30 days from the date the declaration of emergency is issued. Whether that declaration of emergency is at the state level, the county level, or the city level, it triggers that anti-price gouging law. What that means is you cannot increase rents more than 10% while that anti-price gouging law is in effect, which, like I said, is at least 30 days following that declaration, and it can be extended by the government for an even longer period of time. So again, keep that in mind. What I do know now is that the rainstorm declaration, the state level, that more than 30 days has passed since that one was issued. So that has lifted and the anti-price gouging laws are not implicated under that one. But the snowstorm ones, that was just issued March 1st. So through the end of this month, if you're in one of the affected counties, a county that doesn't experience snow, then you're obviously not going to be impacted. But some of the Sierra counties would be impacted by those declarations.
Reno, Tahoe.
Reno's in Nevada, but definitely, I believe Placer County is listed on that emergency declaration, if I remember correctly. And then the duration, like I mentioned, is at least 30 days would be the anti-price gouging, unless it's extended by the government. So keep that in mind as well if you're in one of the impacted areas and you're looking to increase rents. So again, like I said, I'm going kind of quickly here. One of the things that sort of slipped through the radar here is AB 1482, which is statewide rent and eviction control. And I say it slipped under the radar, even though it's been effective since January 2020, is, well, what happened in 2020? What happened early in 2020? COVID-19. So this huge rollout of statewide rent and eviction control was sort of overshadowed by, you know, all the impacts of COVID-19, all the regulations, rules, laws, and all the focus is on that. But guess what? Up and running and strong is statewide rent and eviction control. You must have just cause to evict no matter where you are in California. If you're not in one of the traditional Los Angeles, Santa Monica, San Francisco, Berkeley, Oakland jurisdictions that have long had rent and eviction control. Guess what? Your rental properties still may be regulated under AB 1482, which is statewide rent and eviction control, requiring just cause to evict and limiting annual rent increases to no more than 5% plus CPI, not to exceed 10%. Now, you know, some of you may be panicking. Well, you know, there are exceptions to AB 1482, such as single family homes are generally exempt. But if you own, you know, multi-unit properties, you're most likely going to fall under the rent and eviction controls. All right. So just keep that in mind. ADA claims. This one I found interesting, and I've seen a little rise in this as well. As some of you may know, you know, long for many years, there's been sort of what I call the drive-by ADA. ADA stands for American with Disabilities Act, but sort of the drive-by ADA claim where a person with an impairment or disability just drives by a business, looks and sees that, well, hey, look, you know, maybe that door is not wide enough to enter to get a wheelchair in, or maybe the slope of the entryway is too steep for a wheelchair, whatever it may be. They sort of drive by, go in and see that there's some access, it's lacking in some access under the disability requirements, and files a lawsuit against that property owner. And in those cases, it's almost a given that the landlord will be liable for a certain sum of money to that tenant for that lack of access or that blocked access. Well, guess what? That includes not just buildings, but if you have a business with a website, that website must be accessible as well to persons with disabilities. So an example might be someone with a visual or an audio impairment. They may not be able to, you know, visually see things on your website that someone else may be able to, or listen to video, you know, an audio playing you have. Well, you need to make it accessible for persons with impairments. And there are services out there. You can subscribe to a service who will access and assess your website and see whether or not it's compliant. And if not, you know, you pay some money and then they will bring it up to the requirements. But this was sort of a new thing that I saw and found kind of interesting. You know, instead of the drive-by lawsuit to a building, it's like a flyby on the web where they're checking websites and seeing whether they're compliant. And if not, then maybe you get a demand or some sort of a lawsuit for violating the American with Disabilities Act. And then Section 8 housing discrimination, effective in, I think it was 2020, maybe in 2021, landlords can no longer refuse to rent to someone based on participation in Section 8, you know, which is a government subsidy for rental units. And you cannot terminate someone on the basis of obtaining housing, you know, the housing authority stipend, or if they're a Section 8 applicant to rent. And if you do, you could face a fair housing lawsuit. And there's a lot of that going around where I'm seeing testers, so to speak, people who will call up and ask whether or not the landlord accepts a Section 8 housing. And when the landlord balks or says no, then that tester will then file some claim either with a local agency or file a claim in court against that landlord. And I've seen a lot of that going on, particularly here in the Bay Area and particularly in San Francisco. So be aware of that. You have to open your doors to Section 8, and you can't, you know, reject them solely on the basis of them participating in the Section 8 program. All right, now insurance. So I've gone through, let's see, it's been about 15 minutes. I want to turn this over to Dave here in a minute, but I want to sort of wrap it up with the importance of insurance. As a property owner who rents property, you need to always make sure that you have a policy that is one for landlords, not your typical fire policy or your owner-occupier policy, but one specifically as a landlord that protects you against tenant claims. And particularly what I'm looking for are protection against personal injury and wrongful eviction, a policy that includes coverage for those types of things. And one thing that I'm seeing as well is not updating your policy to make sure that the right people are insured. If you have multiple, maybe you own with your brother or cousin or uncle, whatever, make sure that all of you are named on that policy. Also, let's say it's in your trust. Make sure that that policy includes your trust, you as the trustee of your trust, and individually, if the carrier will do that. And I've seen they typically do. If you own it in your LLC, then you want to ensure that the named insured is the LLC. And if possible, also the members of the LLC individually, name them. Because if a tenant files a lawsuit, guess who they're going to sue? They're going to sue the person that they've been dealing with for, you know, the duration of their tenancy, Joe Schmo or whoever that person may be. They don't care that Joe Schmo is the member of ABC LLC. They're going to sue Joe Schmo as well as the ABC LLC. So if possible, make sure that, you know, anyone who is associated with the ownership is also named as an insured. Here's just a story. I had to defend a case. A client owned a property. I believe it was owned in her trust, if I remember correctly. But she had her insurance policy in her name. Jane Doe individually, and her policy covered her individually. And the trust was Jane Doe as trustee for her living trust. That's how the title was held. And so the tenant sues. And who does the tenant sue? Well, it sues Jane Doe. And it sues, they look, you know, the attorney, as any tenant attorney is probably going to do, is they look up on title. Well, who's the owner? We're going to sue that as well. And it's Jane Doe as trustee of the trust. So Jane Doe trustee and Jane Doe individually is the same person acting the same way, all right, on her own behalf, her own interests. And what happened was the insurance company said, well, we will represent Jane Doe. We don't have to represent the trust. We're not going to represent you as trustee of the trust. Even though you're the same person, you have to go out and hire a different attorney to represent you, the same person, as the trustee of your trust. And I felt that was ridiculous because it's the same person. They require the same defense. Nothing changes between the defenses of Jane Doe as trustee and Jane Doe individually. It's the same person defending the lawsuit. But she had to come out and hire my firm to, you know, tag along and make all the same defenses that she did, you know, under her insurance company's defense for the trustee, or excuse me, for the individual. And then when it came time to settle, which most of these cases do, they said, well, we'll settle, but we'll pay on behalf of the individual, you know, a portion of the money, but the trustee should be responsible as well. So you have to pony up some money as well. Again, ludicrous, but that's the position the insurance company took. So just be aware that insurance companies are looking after themselves. Any way to cut their costs and their outlay in defending a lawsuit, they're going to try to do oftentimes. So that's why I have this, the importance of ensuring that the proper people are named as insureds on the policies. And then an umbrella policy. I've always liked the idea of the umbrella policy because now that's not in lieu of a property policy. That's in addition to the property policy. So if you have your property policy with all the proper people insured, then the umbrella kicks in over and above the liability limits of that property policy. And if there's any chink in the armor of that underlying property policy, sometimes the umbrella policy will kick in and cover you anyways. So I kind of like the idea of the umbrella policy as well, not only to give you additional protection in terms of how much money you have, but also as a possible drop down to cover something that that might not be covered in your property policy. It's a little bit technical, but so umbrella policies are a good idea oftentimes, especially if you have multiple things to cover, like a residence, a rental property or two, cars, boats, other things. You can get the umbrella to sort of bring all those things under it. So those are oftentimes a good idea.
So with that, I was going to say, I see David shaking his head. I know he's going to have some comments about insurance too. And great example that you brought up, Steve.
Yeah. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and I don't know if you have any questions, Paul, but I'm going to go ahead and stop the share.
Yeah. I'll just say one thing as we transition to David is interesting, the insurance thing, because it came up at our firm that a woman who owned a building and had a tenant with a physical therapy practice living on the unit and had insurance. And this physical therapist had a client come on the property, which she wasn't supposed to do, to do her thing there. She had an office that she would go to, but had this client. Client got injured. There was construction going on and sued. And the woman found out she didn't have the right kind of insurance to cover this. You know, this was related to a, a client of her renter coming on the property. So it speaks to your exact case, is know your insurance.
Yeah. That's important to get the property policy. And that person probably thought that she had the right coverage in place. So it's a good idea to have an open communication with your insurance agent, to let the agent know how you're using that property. Yep. And that's where I get into a lot of cases where you'll see, someone will come to me with a tenant lawsuit and they've got a homeowner policy, a fire policy, but not a landlord policy. And they say, well, yeah, I used to live there, so I had that policy, and then I moved out and started renting it. That's a communication you need to have with your agent, your insurance agent, so that they know that, hey, this fire policy is no longer, protective enough for you. You're no longer living there. You need a liability policy that will cover you for tenant claims.
Yep. Great stuff. I want to mention, David, as we get in with you, I just put up in the chat there, as you start listening to David and Steve here, if you've got questions, and particularly on David's asset protection for property owners, there's a link there I put up. You can get one-on-one with David, complimentary. If you have questions about your own situation, take advantage of that. There's a link there that gets you to his calendar. So I've been to the asset protection side here, and where do you want to start?
I guess I can start by dovetailing with what Steve said in terms of insurance. Into number one, I'm always an advocate of getting as much insurance as you possibly can. Make sure you communicate with your agent and broker exactly what the use of the property is going to be. And, if your broker or your agent's not giving you the time of day, or you don't feel the agent or broker's listening to you, or maybe, not the right fit, remember that there are tons of agents and brokers out there who would love to have your business. So go to one that you're able to communicate with, work with, and who's going to take the time to tailor policies to you, not just to sell you stuff, but to make sure that you've got the right fit and that you're taken care of. And also with respect to the insurance, keep in mind that, insurance companies are a big business. So the very first thing they do when they get presented, as lawyers call it, tendered with a claim, they're going to look for ways to deny it at first. Okay, do we even have to cover this? Is this something we have to provide a defense for? Something we have to provide coverage for? And so they will do things like Steve said. They'll go, okay, well, we'll cover the individual, but not the trust that actually owns the property, right? Or something along those lines. So you always want to make sure, and I say at least do this annually, go over your insurance, go over it with your agent, your broker, make sure that you've got everything that you need to have covered. And then have all the people and entities that you need to have covered as well. As Steve said, it could be, if it's a limited liability company that's holding property, make sure they're included. The members of the LLC are included, or a land trust or something, whatever you have that you know, make sure you have as expansive an umbrella as it comes in terms of coverage, not only for events, but also for the people that are there, because a lot of people, you know, realize that they need coverage for the underlying damage or liability, but at the same token, they also forget how expensive it is to hire lawyers to defend you and to pay out of your pocket as well. And providing a defense is a huge part of your insurance policy as well. So don't neglect that.
Yeah. And David, getting into the legal entities for rental property owners, you know, I know we speak to apartment associations all across the country and deal with many liabilities that come into the firm from everywhere when you own property. I mean, as you often say, owning property is a great investment, but it comes with a footprint of potential liability. So how would you advise somebody, like, what are some of the nuances of the legal entities, the LLC, that they should be aware of? And when they own rental property, why have an LLC, and what are some of the pieces of it that we should be aware of?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, own property. They're very, you know, focused on accumulating property, right? Buying property, selling property, that sort of thing. And a lot of times they overlook the legal pitfalls of the potential legal liability because they're busy doing business. They're wheeling and dealing and trying to expand their investment portfolio. And so a lot of them end up holding their properties just as by themselves in their own name, which unbeknownst to them exposes themselves and the property and their portfolio to a risk of liability from potential creditors who are tenants, for example, in what we would call inside liability, tenants or business operations on the property, or what we would call outside liability, meaning the obligations that the property owner may have that are not related to that property, but expose the property and the risk of foreclosure or losing the property in the event of a judgment against the individual. So in order to guard against that, we recommend that you, if you're holding property, that you put it in either a corporation or a limited liability company, whatever structure you feel comfortable with, to shield yourself and your property from the risk of liability, potential foreclosure due to a judgment, be it from a tenant that sues you for something that's going on in the property, and maybe even something that's not covered by insurance, like mold or something along those lines, or other obligations that you have that aren't directly related to the property. But if you get a judgment, they could be liquidated to use to satisfy a judgment. And when I say corporations, we don't do a lot of corporations as real property holding entities anymore. We prefer to do limited liability.
Yeah, I was going to ask you the difference there.
And because with a corporation, you have inside liability against the actions of tenants or the conduct of people that happen to be either occupying or visiting the property. But you don't have outside liability protection, meaning that if somebody, you know, somebody gets a judgment against you for some, maybe you get into a really bad car accident that exceeds the limits of liability on your car insurance, and you get hit with a judgment that exceeds your insurance coverage, and people are looking to collect, then they can turn around and look to foreclose on your ownership interests in a corporation to do that. Whereas with a limited liability company, you get the inside protection as it relates to tenants and guests and activities on the property, but you also get the outside protection in that creditors, people that hold judgments against you are not able to collect on their judgment by liquidating your property or liquidating that LLC asset. What they get instead is called a charging order. And a charging order is basically a lien against any ownership distributions or your economic interests in the limited liability company, but they can't foreclose on the ownership interest in the LLC or the membership interest, you know, which would give them the rights of ownership. And they can't foreclose in some jurisdictions, they can't foreclose on the economic interest. In California, they can, but it's after they have to show that they've been frustrated in their attempts to collect on the judgment for an extended period of time. But And that goes into why a lot of times what we will do is we will form limited liability companies in other jurisdictions and then authorize them to do business in California, because those other jurisdictions provide better protection on your economic interest.
So the fact that you own property in California doesn't mean you got to have a California LLC, David. You can go and choose another state.
Correct. Yeah, you could choose another state. A lot of times I use these as examples, like Wyoming, Nevada, Delaware are great examples of jurisdictions where you can form a limited liability company, authorize them to do business in California, have the property held in that LLC. And as long as you are compliant with all of California's laws, meaning that you're up to date on all your form filings, you're paying the minimum tax that's required, or you're current with the tax obligations, courts in California will enforce the creditor-debtor laws of the other state or the other jurisdiction when it comes to trying to move against your interest in the limited liability company. And in Wyoming, Nevada, Delaware, for example, they're limited to proceeding on the charging order, which is they have to stick around and wait to see if there's going to be distributions from the LLC, that sort of thing. They can't foreclose on your economic interest or really do anything else. So it's a great deterrent for people to file lawsuits against you. And if they do, then it's a great imperative for them to try to settle those claims, either within the limits of your insurance or to look at some other means or to greatly reduce the value of any legal judgments or settlements they may want to pursue against your property and your interest.
Well, David, I want to ask you this too. That's great information because, LLCs, it's almost like earthquake insurance on your house, right? The idea is that you need it to work when there's a problem, right? And so with the LLCs, they're really easy to bang out today. Online people can bang them out all the time, but it's when something happens and the LLC gets tested is really when the rubber meets the road. And so what are the important components of the LLC that you would advise a client, say, hey, if you're setting this up and imagine you're getting sued and you need this thing to work and be bulletproof, should have they done to set that up in the first place so that it doesn't fall apart if there is something going on?
In terms of asset protection, I think it's always if you're looking to form the LLC to protect the asset and protect yourself, which is really what you should be doing, I think you really need to speak to an attorney that has experience in doing that kind of thing so they can draft an operating agreement, which is essential to have.
Why?
You're a single member LLC because the operating agreement sets the rules of the road for the management of the LLC. And you can put provisions in the operating agreement to even further lock down the asset protection provisions that come along, or the asset protection benefits of having the limited liability company in the first place. And if you go to an online provider of those kind of services, they're likely not going to have those in their operating agreement. So they're not going to listen to you if you want to fine tune those. It's going to cost you more money and that sort of thing. Or maybe they just stick you with a lawyer, and it can be a real hassle when you can just go to a one-stop shop and get it all done.
Well, what happens if somebody gets sued and they don't have an operating agreement? Because you don't have to have one when you set up an LLC. Let's say you're doing it on your own. What actually is the downside of not having it? What will the attorney attacking you do?
It'll fall back onto to California law, and so whatever the limited liability company act says, that the same thing with a partnership or something, or corporation, something along those lines. In terms of what your exposure is going to be, you'll still have that protection, but it'll be limited to what the state says you have. Like, for example, if you have a California LLC, that's supposed to be
in your operating agreement. Yeah, your sound just went low, David. Your sound just
went low. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, not close enough to my mic. I apologize.
Yeah, no. So what you're saying there is if you don't create your own operating agreement and you do get attacked, then it defaults to the state off the shelf, language, which isn't always in your best interest. You want to have a tailored document. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. That's accurate and 100% correct. You want to have something that you've had input on, where, you know, you, and if it's you by yourself or you with partners, which would at that point be fellow limited liability company members, where you determine how you're going to do business and have that dictated to you, then rather than have somebody else dictate it to you, right?
Got
you
it.
Take care of your own business, or somebody will take care of your business for you. It's kind of the old adage there.
And then as far as the people on that single member versus multi-member, you know, husband and wife, can you put kids on? Is there a downside to just having you be the only person involved with the LLC? I mean, what do people need to know about that?
I think it's always preferable to have multiple member LLCs if you can. You know, in California doesn't even really recognize single member LLCs.
They look at
them as, yeah, more or less as a fiction or an alter ego of the owner. But other jurisdictions do. Like I said, Wyoming, which I've said before, they do. Nevada does. But still, even there, it's preferable to have multiple member LLCs because they're less likely to be foreclosed upon in any way, shape, or form. In California, it's mandatory that you really need to have a multiple member LLC. If you're going to have a single member, I would not recommend forming directly in California. I'd recommend using a jurisdiction that expressly allows single member LLCs and then authorizing it to do business here in California.
And you could have the split be, you know, if you don't have a business partner, let's say you own it on your own, it could be 99, you 1% for your kid or something like that. Is that right? And
Correct. And you know, we may recommend that maybe make the percentage just a little bit higher, but at the same token, it's also a great way of bringing your kids or loved ones or other people into the reckoning in terms of ownership of the property, if you have a plan to pass that along at some point in time as well. So you get not only the asset protection benefits, but you get the, you know, succession benefits as well. That are available with limited liability company ownership.
I got kind of a one-off question there. If you have somebody, let's say it's an 80-20 split and there's income flowing out of the property, are each of those members claiming their share of that income flow, 80-20, on their tax returns?
Normally, yes. If you're holding it as a pass-through type entity for taxation, then yes, the tax, the benefits, the positives and the negatives will flow through to the owners proportional to their ownership interest in the property.
Okay. And then how about if you've got a living trust? So, you know, I know you do a lot of estate planning and you're always counseling, you know, everyone, you got to have your estate plan in place. It's just one of these inevitabilities in life. And it's going to happen to all of us. And this is your living trust to avoid probate and so forth. And we've seen so many property owners just get nailed when they don't have their living trust in there and it goes to probate. So as you advise people, okay, get your living trust done, but then they also got an LLC for the property because the living trust is not an asset protection vehicle. How do you mesh those two things together?
Yeah, first of all, plug for estate planning. It's cheap to do. But it's absolutely 100% essential. Estate planning, you know, some attorneys like our firm, for example, is part of our estate planning package. We have healthcare directives, property management directives that, you know, take care of you if you're incapacitated but not yet passed away. And then obviously wills and trusts, which take effect when you pass, right? And what those do is dictate how you want your assets distributed, you know, at the time of death. And if you don't do that, then if you pass away without a will, without a trust, or even if you just pass away with a will, the courts are going to have to get involved. And that could take a long time and cost a lot of money. And also may not turn out exactly the way you like. When you've got your estate plan and you're dictating how you want you know your affairs handled and administered should something happen to you. And as far as how an LLC works with that scenario, what you would do is transfer your membership in the LLC into your living trust. So again, you know, if you pass away or something happens to you, You can dictate how you want that LLC to be, ownership of that LLC to be handled, how you want it to be passed along, instead of leaving it in the hands of court where it could take 6 months, a year plus, and cost a lot of money to get taken care of and get done.
Which brings up a question. If you've got a business partner in a property and you say, hey, we need an LLC, they don't want to do the LLC because they I don't want to pay for it. They don't see the need for it for whatever reason. Can you do an LLC for your membership interest in the property?
Yes, you can. If it's held specifically, if it's held in like tenants in common, for example, or something along those lines, you can take your interest and put it into a limited liability company. I'd probably advise you to do that if you could.
Right. But the problem is, if the other person doesn't do that, and let's say they've got estate planning issues over there, they get probated or whatever's going on with their 20% of your property, you're screwed, right? Because your property gets all tangled up over there in their estate plan. Is that accurate?
It could be. I think, but I also think even holding it in an interest that's not necessarily like joint tenancy, for example, complicates things, right? Because, they could possibly, foreclose and liquidate and take that person's share, but hopefully not be able to take yours. But it just, it creates all sorts of, the property could get sold out from under you, but what they recover at the end of the day might be a bit less. So it's something where I think something is better than nothing in that regard, and taking steps to try to insulate your interest from those who don't want to insulate what they have is a good thing if you can do it.
Yep. Great information. Appreciate it, both of you. And I want to say again that we're going to record this video. We are recording. We're going to get it out to everybody who signed up. And there will be contact information for both David and Steve there. Steve will put your information around there. So wherever somebody's watching the video, you can get a hold of Steve and his firm. I did put in the chat there a link to get one-on-one on David's calendar. You can click on that and check it out. If you have any questions at all on estate planning, asset protection, take advantage of that. And I want to thank both of you again, David and Steve, for being here. Excellent information. We'll for sure have you back.
Great. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Fantastic.
See ya. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, take care. Sing it louder.